All right. Once again, apologies to anyone cut off mid-sentence as the breakout rooms close. All right. I will go around and say hello to each person who is here, starting with Linda and Bob K, Joseph, Karen, Aaron, Alice, Mark, Jinryu, Andy, Sam, who has a hawk is just about to land on your head, and Marv, Jim, Sarah, Shoketsu, Mary, Jeannie, Ken, Joan, John, Mick, Katie, Claudia, Abdullah, Pat, Sabrina, Peter, Bob O, and Ruthann. All right, nice group here today. Let's see, I can't think of any announcements. Can anybody else? Or any questions about what's going on? We have a one-day retreat that's coming up in April. Beginning of April is our Vesak ceremony, which happens on a Sunday, Festival of the Buddha's Birth. That'll be fun. Yeah, just make sure if you aren't already that you are signed up for our weekly email newsletter, which you can do by going to the front page of the website and, just signing up there. And that lets you know, class series that are coming up, other opportunities, stuff like that.
There's Domio, there's a meeting of the book group on the 20th. It's a week from this coming Saturday.
Okay.
So and if anyone's interested, there is an announcement in the newsletter announcing the date and how to get a hold of me if people are interested in joining. Thank you.
Great. Abdullah.
Sorry about that. I remember you mentioning something about a class on the precepts. When is that to begin, or has it begun?
That is beginning on Tuesday evenings in April. So on the website, if you go under our practice, and I think then it's study and Tuesday study, there's a list of classes and like what each topic is and what the suggested reading is. And I think, I'm not sure if you go to the calendar, whether the calendar will say, precept classes, but we should make it say the precept classes so then it'll start somewhere like second or third week in April, I think, and then go through May and most of June, and then our precept ceremony will be toward the end of June.
I don't know if this helps, but lately I've been going on the website and just searching for Tuesday. And that seems to be real profitable in finding whatever's going on Tuesdays. We all have different search skills these days, I think.
And also the newsletter tends to mention what's coming up next as well, but not indefinitely. But once the precept classes are on the horizon, the newsletter will start mentioning them, and they will be recorded. Bob does our recording and edits things up and puts them on the website. So sometimes it takes a couple days, but if you are unable to attend those Tuesday night classes, you can listen to them later. Okay, today I'm going to do my fourth talk on the Lotus Sutra. So this is one of our classic Mahayana texts, which was compiled probably over the course of about 100, 150 years around maybe like first century BCE to about 150 CE. So a long time ago, about 2000 year old book. And perhaps arguably one of the most popular of Mahayana sutras around the world and in many forms of Buddhism. And I've told the story before that, you know, I initially, when I was studying this about 20 years ago or a little bit more at Dharma Rain, I really didn't like it at all. I mean, if what really appeals to you is like that kind of Zen, the real Zen flavor, this is very different. But as part of our study, you know, we had what we called a seminary study, and we just exposed ourselves to these teachings, whether we particularly liked them or not. And I found it useful. So I've warmed up to it. And I find it very surprising that such an old book has messages that seem so relevant and personal to us today. I find that this, it's not a psychological text, but it's certainly compatible with modern psychology. So it's not taking the point of view of the like subjective experience of the individual, but it does address a lot about like self-esteem and it feels like it has many, many parables that are directly relevant to the way that we view ourselves and the way that we view our relationship to practice and our capacity for practice, etc. So what I'm calling this talk is the Lotus Sutra Parable of the Plants, Superior, Middling, or Inferior Beings and the Dharma. So let's see, I'm going to read a short section of this parable to get us started. So this is the parable of the plants, sometimes called the parable of the medicinal herbs, but the parable of the plants. And this is a Jean Reeves translation. The rain falls everywhere, coming down on all sides, flowing everywhere without limit, reaching over the face of the earth, into the hidden recesses of mountains, streams, and steep valleys, where plants and trees grow, and medicinal herbs, big trees and small. 100 grains, rice seedlings, sugar cane, and grapevines, all are moistened by the rain and abundantly enriched. The dry ground is soaked, and both herbs and trees flourish. By the same water that comes from that cloud, plants, trees, thickets, and forests, according to their need, receive moisture. All the trees, superior, middling, or inferior, each according to its size, can grow and develop. Roots, stems, branches, and leaves, blossoms and fruit in brilliant color, one rain goes to all, and all become bright and shiny. Through their bodies, forms, and capacities, though they may be large or small, the moisture they receive is the same, enabling each to flourish. The Buddha is like this. He appears in the world like a great cloud, universally covering all things. Having appeared in the world for the sake of living beings, he makes distinctions in teaching. It makes distinctions in teaching the reality of all things. The great saint, the world honored one, to human and heavenly beings, and in the midst of all beings, declares, "I am the Tathagata, most honored among people. I appear in the world like a great cloud. to shower water on all parched living beings, to free them from suffering, and so attain the joys of peace and comfort, the joys of this world, and the joy of nirvana. So that's all well and good. The Buddha is a very generous teacher, doesn't discriminate, just, you know, shares with all beings. And this is, like I said, this is, I'm going to talk about kind of the psychological repercussions of this, but really this is about the nature of Buddhist teaching. The idea being that there's nothing special that the Buddha gives to certain beings, but not to others. It's like the rain of Dharma is showered down equally on all beings, and they just take what they need. And this is actually the origin of the name of the Zen center that I trained at, Dharma Rain Zen Center. But the metaphor of medicinal herbs and, you know, superior, middling, and inferior trees, which, you know, they're just talking about the size of the trees, does have a clear interpretation that is offered within this chapter. So this is all the rest that I will read. So eminent and humble, high and low, precept keepers and precept breakers, those of great character and those who are imperfect, those of correct views and those of wrong views, quick-witted and dull-witted, I have the Dharma rain equally on all, without sparing or neglecting any. When any living being staying in any environment hear my Dharma, they receive it according to their abilities. Some dwell among human and heavenly beings, or with wheel-turning saintly kings, or with Indra, Brahma, or other kings. These are like the smaller medicinal herbs. Some understand the flawless Dharma and are able to attain nirvana, acquire the six divine powers, and obtain the three kinds of knowledge. Some live alone in mountain forests and practice meditation and become Pratyeka Buddhas. These are the medium-sized medicinal herbs. Some seek to be like the world-honored one, saying, I will become a Buddha. They persevere and practice meditation. These are the superior medicinal herbs. And there are children of the Buddha who completely devote themselves to the Buddha way, always practicing compassion. They are assured that they will become Buddhas and have no doubt about it. These are called small trees. Some dwelling in peace with divine powers turn the irreversible wheel, liberating innumerable millions of living beings. Such bodhisattvas are called large trees. So notably, the sutra says that the Buddha, in her great wisdom, can discern. That's part of the skill of a Buddha. A Buddha is not just an awakened being, but a very skillful teacher. So the Buddha can, when encountering beings, can tell what kind of capacity they have, what kind of ability they have, where they're coming from. And but they themselves may not be aware of whether they are superior or middling or inferior. It just matters that the Buddha knows. So my reaction to this parable, when I first encountered it about 20 years ago, and I just have, I'd be curious to know. And when we get to Q&A, you can share. I'd be curious to know what the different kind of responses and reactions to this are. I'm sure we're all over the map. But my response was that of resentment and insecurity. So if you don't have this response yourself, I will explain. And I would just preface also by saying this is not some of the aspects that I'm going to take out of this parable today is not like this is the teaching of the Lotus Sutra parable of the plants, right? This is, I don't know, this is my response to it and what I learned from it. So to me, this parable says, so we quote in one of our dedications during chanting, something that I love that is directly from the Lotus Sutra. It says, even little children in their play who gather sand and make it into stupas, all such beings have fulfilled the Buddha way. So there's something really special about Mahayana and about the Lotus Sutra that it kind of levels the playing field, if you will. So, you know, all beings, it opens, rather than the idea that you need to be a spiritual athlete in order to attain awakening, that there's something, you know, we all have Buddha nature. And the Dharma is accessible to us all. So despite that message, this parable is saying, oh, but there really are superior, middling, and inferior practitioners. And here's what they are. So to me, it was like this reminder that there is superior, middling, and inferior in the eyes of the Buddha. And kind of more personally, even though my Zen teacher was generous and kind and non-judgmental and seemed to offer the Dharma energetically and openly to all her students, it's like, so she sees superior, middling, and inferior too, right? And it seems like even though the playing field is level, there are beings who are going to awaken, attain liberation, get it, succeed, progress faster than others. And I was trying in my practice to let go of comparison and worrying too much about my own progress and being, you know, spiritually materialistic about it. But here there's this message, like there really are differences in terms of, you know, wisdom, compassion, freedom from delusion, etc. And I was trying really hard to be diligent in my practice. I really was trying to be a decent sized shrub or a small tree, at least, right? But when I heard the parable, I just knew I was a medicinal herb. I just knew, I'm like, You're talking about me as a medicinal herb, aren't you? And then, you know, as a medicinal herb too, it's like, yeah, and you probably aren't even aware of how thoroughly you're a medicinal herb, right? Because, you know, the herbs are still a little ignorant. And the parable also seemed to state that in life, whether we are superior, middling, or inferior, was pretty much beyond our control, not really something that we could change. You know, this parable wasn't about, and then the medicinal herbs grow, and then they become shrubs, and then they become trees. It's just like, no, the medicinal herbs just take what they need and flourish as medicinal herbs. So there's a sense that, okay, if I'm a medicinal herb, and I'm sure my Dharma brother is a tree, like he's always going to be ahead of me. He's always going to have more of a capacity than I do. Permanently superior to me, and I can never catch up. So presumably this parable is meant to be encouraging, right? The Buddha is wise, able to discern the differing needs and abilities of beings and then teaches them appropriately. This is skillful means. Right? And any of us who have tried to teach anything understand what this is. It depends on our audience. It depends on the person. It depends on the child. You know, one approach that works with somebody else isn't going to work with this person. Maybe gentleness, maybe strictness, maybe setting a boundary, whatever. We change up the way that we share or teach based on what the person needs. So that's encouraging. And the Buddha's not holding anything back, right? Showering the Dharma rain equally, has the best interests of all beings in mind. And then, and a matter of fact, in another part of the chapter, the Buddha says, I look upon all things without exception as equal. I have no interest anywhere in favoring one over another, or in cherishing one and hating another. And another positive message is that no matter what our capacities, the Dharma is beneficial, will benefit and grow from the reign of the Dharma. So that's great. But I'd be curious to know whether I'm so different from others, but it felt a little bit like finding out, okay, so your parents unequivocally love and cherish you and your siblings equally. But they also regularly discuss how your siblings are smarter, more responsible, more capable, more talented, generally more likable than you are. And, you know, to talk about what kind of special treatment you need in order to thrive. Frankly, it just hurts the ego. As long as the ego is involved, you know, this arouses fear or the conclusion of inferiority, arouses fear of being, and this is different, seen as inferior by others, especially if they're able to perceive what you cannot, perhaps arousing some social anxiety. It raises doubts that you can actually understand Buddhism or achieve much in practice, if maybe you're just a medicinal herb and you don't know it. And one of the things that we learn over the course of practice is, you know, as Dogen says in Genjo Koan, to study Buddhism is to study the self. So generally speaking, and this is a good thing, we become more and more intimate with our own limitations, with our own karmic reactivity, with our own delusions and lack of compassion and self-absorption and tendency to be lazy and tendency to just, you know, seek pleasure rather than do things that are hard, all kinds of things. So it's very difficult not to conclude that, you know, we're all medicinal herbs and that, you know, trees are pretty rare. Trees are like really special people, which is kind of out of keeping with the whole, you know, the way that we approach practice and the way that the other messages of the Lotus Sutra, right? That like we're all equal players in this, but oh, well, then there's the special trees that really have the great ability or aspirations. So there's different possible reactions, I mean, to this parable. Other than the ego being challenged. I mean, maybe you are perfectly comfortable with being a medicinal herb. And maybe you don't even have the slightest concern or curiosity even about what kind of plant the Buddha would see you as. And I think that, frankly, I think that's a kind of spiritual maturity that is really great. And maybe it means that you're a tree and not a medicinal herb. I don't know. But on the other hand, you may be really ready to embrace the idea that you're a medicinal herb, but there could be a certain measure of a certain hint of shame in that because it fits with your narrative that you're an inferior kind of person. You're like, oh yeah, I'm just a medicinal herb. You know, so I don't know that's not really the point of this either. So if we do have any kind of negative reaction to this parable or to similar ego challenges in our lives, what can we do? How can we practice? What can we learn? So generally speaking, I mean, you can make some headway this way, but generally speaking, it's not a lasting transformative solution to just try not to think or feel what you're thinking and feeling. I mean, sometimes you fake it till you make it. You just, you know, break yourself out of a particular mindset or negative loop of thinking. And sometimes that works. Kind of over time, if you have a karmic tendency toward a particular way of thinking or feeling, you usually can't just will yourself out of it. And the fact that you can't will yourself out of it can just like feed into the negativity sometimes too. So I guess instead, you know, this is the opportunity to look at this kind of thing. One of the ways that we phrase this is to, you know, look at it as a koan, look at it as a problem that isn't something that you can just think yourself through and somebody can just give you an answer and you're like, oh, okay. You have to live the answer. You have to experience the answer for yourself. So there's some point of tension or discomfort or confusion. What is this? What is going on here? So we turn the light around and shine awareness on what is going on within us. What do we really care about? What do we most want? What's underneath the fears about superior, middling, and inferior? What's underneath the concern about being judged by others? Is there a deeper motivation in our practice beyond the possibility of attaining some level of mastery that would qualify us as a tree? I mean, in the long run, what's the point, right? So what's underneath it? What are we really hoping to reach in our practice? So Buddhism does not deny differences. That's the relative, right? There is wiser and deluded. There are people who can concentrate better than others. There are people who are more self-disciplined than others. There are, you know, and we can make some progress in some of these areas. So this is the relative. To deny that would be folly. And yet Buddhism is pointing us toward something else as well. It's not just about the relative. So I think it's amazing that this 2,000-year-old book points us toward what I see as a need for profound self-acceptance and healing. So I'm going to add just a line to a section from this chapter that points this out. So the first parts are from the sutra, and then I'll depart. So roots, stems, branches, and leaves, blossoms and fruit in brilliant color. One rain goes to all, and all become bright and shiny. Though their bodies, forms, and capacities may be large or small, and this is my part, each plant fulfills the beauty of the Buddha way by fulfilling its unique potential. So this reminded me, very conveniently, this also uses the metaphor of plants, of one of my favorite stories about Uchiyama Roshi and his teacher, Sawaki Roshi. So Uchiyama Roshi, 20th century Zen teacher. This is from the Zen teachings of Homeless Kodo. So Kosho Uchiyama is the student and Sawaki Roshi was his teacher. So this is Uchiyama. He says, throughout his life, Sawaki Roshi said, Zazen is good for nothing. In 1941, I was ordained and became one of his disciples. Soon after, while walking with him, I asked, I am such a timid person. If I study under your guidance and practice Zazen with you for many years until you pass away, can I become a little bit stronger? He immediately replied, no, you can't. No matter how hard and how long you practice, Zazen is good for nothing. I didn't become who I am as a result of Zazen. By nature, I was this kind of person. On this point, I haven't changed at all. As you know, Sawaki Roshi was big-hearted, free-spirited, and witty, and yet careful and focused. He embodied the image of the ancient Zen master. When I heard his response, I thought, although Roshi says so with his mouth, if I continue to practice Zazen, I must be able to become a better person. With such an expectation, I served him and continued Zazen practice until he died. He passed away on December 21st last year. We'll mark the first anniversary of his death soon. Lately, I've been reflecting on my past, and now I understand that Zazen really is good for nothing. I'm still a coward and never became even a little bit like Sawaki Roshi. Finally, I came to a conclusion. A violet blooms as a violet, and a rose blooms as a rose. For violets, there's no need to desire to become roses. So I guess I see this as a invitation to explore and realize the, I mean, part of this is just the nature of reality, but also very intimately how our self manifests in that reality. The simultaneousness of difference and equality. So this is one of our chants is even called that. There is difference and yet everything is equal. And you can kind of study this or think about it. And to some extent, an intellectual or emotional conviction about this is helpful, but it can be deeper than that. And these moments, like a couple of weeks ago, we talked about enlightenment and how really practice is full of enlightenments, you know, moments where we see something clearly, or we understand something, where something transforms us. So this can be, this kind of real personal realization of this can happen. Oftentimes it just happens in a, you know, the light strikes something in a certain way, or you're walking along, or you hear something. I mean, it's just a moment. It's just a moment where things kind of come into alignment, things become clear. And then you can describe this later on to somebody and just be like, one of my enlightenments, I was meditating when I was out camping, and I was sitting behind the wheel of the car. So I'm looking down at the steering wheel, and I just like had this moment where I just knew that all of this was true beyond my imagination. I mean, that sounds kind of lame, right? It's just like, well, I was looking at the steering wheel and I just realized this was always true. But if you've had any of these moments, you know, like, even if it's not something that you can explain or it sounds great, it like, I still remember it, you know, it made a difference in me. And another one of my moments like that, which I've mentioned before, which is related to today's topic, because I did have this obsession with, I don't know, competitiveness and comparison. And if I manifest primarily in any one of the six realms, it's probably the Asura realm. So I had that kind of koan. And then I had during a retreat, and my mind was very still and open. So I had this vision. It's not like a hallucination or anything, but just images arose in my mind in a very free way. I wasn't guiding them or making them up. They just were kind of unfolding. And I just envisioned, it was fall, and they have big leaf maples near the monastery. And it was just, I just had this vision of this bright yellow maple tree, just, you know, radiant, bright yellow. And I was one of the leaves on that tree. So I was unique. I was bright and luminous. I wasn't greater or lesser. I was part of it. And that, like, suddenly, oh, it's like, I see how I can be myself I can be unique, I can be special, I can be complete, but without anyone being less, without any kind of comparison. I'm part of something larger. And that was very, again, that was one of those really impactful moments where I got it at a level, at a gut level. So with that, I'll open it up to comments or questions. And I'd be very curious too, if you have any other kinds of responses to this parable. Maybe there's a whole dimension to it that I'm not even looking at.
If I may, as you were reading the parable, I did get a little bit distracted because I kept thinking to myself, what's wrong with being a medicinal herb? Because medicinal herbs can relieve you from pain, and they can even save your life. And sometimes trees can grow so tall and so thick that they cast such a dense shadow that nothing grows underneath them. So I kept thinking about that, and now I have to go back and read the parable because I may have missed a little bit of it. But I also wanted to say that I did love what you had to say. And in our little breakout group before, we were talking about the documentary film, My Octopus Teacher, which I hope you have seen by now. Have you, Damio? Please. It is such a wonderful film. For those who haven't seen it, you can stream it on Netflix. But that octopus was living the best octopus life she could possibly live. And although some of us cried who watched it because it was so beautiful, you couldn't be sad. Because she knew her, it was like the leaf on the tree. She knew her position in her ocean community. And she knew how she had to live and she knew what she had to do. And it was just really beautiful. In fact, I dare say that if a lot of us watched it, we could actually have a session on My Octopus Teacher. That's all.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful point, especially the image of the big tree casting a big shadow, right? I mean, when we think about, you know, what is going to be the most useful teacher in any given situation, you know, there's going to be some people who might be attracted to some, you know, very charismatic, restrained, accomplished, whatever teacher, and maybe the most useful teacher for you in a given moment might be a fellow Sangha member who's just struggling and said, hey, you know, this is how I dealt with that. And it so it might be a fellow medicinal herb, or yeah, what is required. I really like that. Franklin.
Yeah, hi. Could you read that quote about the rose and the violet again? I read that, really moved me.
Oh, let's see. Yeah, so he says, finally, I came to a conclusion. A violet blooms as a violet, and a rose blooms as a rose. For violets, there's no need to desire to become roses.
Yeah, that's great. It's like the ultimate statement about self-acceptance, you know? I just love it.
And yet,
that's all.
Yeah, and I mean it, and I mean that's that kind of tension between it's not a matter of like, oh, don't worry, we're all roses. We're not. You know, we're not cut out for certain things. we have limitations, but we are who we are. So I guess, yeah, we're, how do we blossom as what we are fully? And you can taste that. You can experience that when you encounter someone who is just, they're just at peace with who they are, appreciative of who they are, joyful about who they are. You know, it's infectious. They don't have to be a, you know, incredibly intelligent or accomplished or whatever.
Domio, it's Joan. I didn't share your reaction to the parable because as you read it, I really liked the equanimity that it implied. And so it's one of those things about the five skandhas where our perceptions are a little different. And I scribbled on my notes and you stole my thunder because what I came up with is that in terms of the relative, we all have different skill levels. Like I could never do what you're doing. And that's a fact. But in terms of the absolute, we're all wonderful. So that is what I came up with. And I really love the whole parable. So I'm sorry I don't agree.
That's great. Mick?
Trying out the raise hand thing. Yeah, it was really interesting. Like I thought about this early in my career as like a teacher. Like I would sort of try and define like whether I was a good teacher or not based on whether like students got it or whatever. And it's always so strange because like I would sort of live moment to moment and like have every single piece of information that came at me to be like a referendum on like who I am as a teacher. And I think, you know, to do that is to just deny like what you are, you know, like I don't need to be everything to every student. And, you know, like I just feel like when you define things and like, am I an oak or a medicinal herb or whatever, like that's just, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, I don't know. I think there's some element of self-denial there that it's hard to get over.
What you were saying just made me picture a children's book about like a medicinal herb who's like, oh, trying to become an oak and is like miserable because they're not a tree and they hope they're going to grow into a tree. And then like, you know, the moral of like, but you're beautiful the way you are.
I cannot tell you how many, like I read a lot of kids' books. I cannot tell you how many of them are like very, very zen, like just like ultimately about, I don't know.
All right. So next is Abdullah. And I'm noticing like, so I'm on speaker view and I'm seeing, so how do you, if you do want to raise your hand electronically, I think you go down.
Under reactions.
Yes. And on the bottom of your screen reactions, and there should be a raised hand. I don't have a raised hand, but I guess I'm host, so I can't raise my hand. All right. Abdullah.
All right. I got a few things from it. The first one, I do agree with the theme of acceptance. Simply because we all know that we're manifestations of it, but we're only working with limited tools. You have your body, your two legs, your hands, a brain, a mind, but yet you know what your nature is, but there's only so much you can do with what you have. So I agree with the thought process of acceptance. The second thing was, I think that it's an ego check, because like you mentioned that Dogen said to study Buddhism is to study the self. And every once in a while, like I remember you mentioning about your history, how you had a certain opinion of yourself when you were in the monastery or whatever. And throughout time, you know, you kind of checked yourself because you started to realize that everything I thought I was, I need to tone it down. And I think that can be beneficial for growth. If you don't have that ego check, if you think you're high and mighty all the time. If the teacher doesn't stand at the front of the class and say, you know, we have some A students, some B students, some C students, then the person never really takes that look at their reflection to better themselves. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think that the superior, middling, and inferior, the tools that we are working with are conditioned and empty. So I don't think that we're stuck. I think that it's just a matter of us accepting what we have and working with it. But the next thing I noticed was, I think it's also a motivation. I think it's a motivation because despite them mentioning those conditioned things about us, you know, you might be short, you might be tall, you might have a strong intellect, you might have been born with something else. The Buddha still said that he sees us all equally. Mm-hmm. So the Buddha sees reality. At the end of the day, the Buddha is someone who sees reality. So despite all of these differences, things that we have to accept, these tools that we have to accept, this is what's in my bag. The reality of it is we are all still equal. So I think it's a motivation that, okay, Tom is doing this, Jan is doing this, but at the end of the day, the one who sees reality as it is said this about all of us. And the final thing that it jumped into my mind early on was the other parable about the son and the father, and the son, he left and you kind of remixed it to make it more modern. He came back. Well, when the father, I think this can be an explanation of that parable as far as teaching someone else and how we deal with our own practice. Because when the father came to him, he saw that he was at a certain level. He tried to hug him. He was like, who is this guy? Are you the police? Right? So then he, by stages, brought him to the realization that, you know, you're worthy of this. Mm. From one job to the next, to where when he actually sprung it on him, he was like, okay, I can see it. I have the self-esteem to deal with this. So I think that this is an explanation of that, or that is the practical application of this parable, because to understand that there's this level of tree or this level of shrub, this level of tree, this level of this level of that, then you take it and you deal with the person, the student, or yourself in your own practice, how the father dealt with the son. You give it to him in stages and build him up over time, understanding that, okay, he's middling right now. You know what I'm saying? He can only deal, I give him the water, I give him the same water that I give Domio, he's only going to be able to do so much with it. If I understand that, then I can through a process, bring him to the point to where, you know, he'll reach his potential. That's what I got.
Thanks, that's awesome. Thank you. I got nothing to add. I was great. Alice.
Can you hear me? I'm using headphones.
Yep.
Okay. How do I not raise my hand? I feel like there's this big slap on my face on the picture. Okay. I used the garden analogy a long time ago when I had two patients back to back, and one was leaving and they both had the same issue. They both had the same scar, was a total knee replacement. And they both looked at each other and they did a quick comparison, you know, how old is she? How old is he? How well he's doing, how well she's doing. And one was leaving, one was coming. And the one that was leaving, you know, I said, bye, you know, see you next week. We're gonna start biking next week, okay? Whereas the one that was coming, you know, it was visible that she was suffering. Like she was having more pain. She was just struggling more. She was like really like internally, psychologically distraught about her issue. And then she said, how long has he been with his knee. And I said, well, I can't really mention anything because of HIPAA, but you guys are roughly on the same path. And she says, well, how come he's back to biking and I'm not, and I'm just in so much pain? And I said, we're all plants in a garden. Some plants need more water. Some plants need less water. He may be a strong tree, but you're an orchid.
Mm.
And you might need more, but you bloom beautifully. And she kind of let go of that comparison. And she was like, she was at peace with where she is, who she was, and all that. And then she turned the metaphor around. She said, what are you? And then I didn't know what to say. So I just said, I'm a weed. I keep, things keep beating me down and I keep coming back. So I'm a weed. And she just left. So yet, I don't know. I just see it like that. I didn't feel any insecurity from the parable because I really see the world as like a garden full of different plants. You could be a flower, you could be medicinal, you could be a tree. We all have different needs, but we're all part of the same garden.
And it really does bring about, like, what is it that we are, what is it that we really want, right? Because I might think to myself, you know, what I really want is to be able to concentrate during Zazen and be really disciplined and, you know, look like this person. But why do I want that? You know, underneath that, I want to know that I'm okay. I want to be at peace. I want to feel a sense of appreciation and joy about my life. You know, so like, do I necessarily need to be a different plant in order to have those things? You know, like, so in a way, it's like, you know, what is it that we can have? What is it we can touch in our practice, regardless? I mean, and some of this stuff is like, you know, you can think of but your example was great because this person is, you know, they're in pain. So some of these aspects, it's not just a matter of like, well, you know, you're short and tall and one person has this talent, one person has that talent. Some of it's really tough. You know, if you have an emotional or physical, psychological disability, you know, that is something that really impacts your life and practice. And to accept that, to accept what, you know, what you may not ever be able to achieve or do, but to somehow bloom as you're supposed to bloom, it can be a tough process. Ruth Ann, did you have something? I noticed you're...
Yes, thank you. Thank you for this timely Dharma talk and the wise comments. I see comparison as a dead-end street, cutting off self-exploration. But for sure, some people have hard, difficult lives. But when we compare, then we cut off the idea of equanimity and embracing impermanence, which no matter what age we are, that is such an embrace that releases our cause of suffering in so many ways, even just for ourselves. So it takes judgment and humility, an easier shirt to wear or experience. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I don't know. There's a time for sympathy and for reaching out and helping people and all of that, but I also think, part of this manifests as our faith that no matter what challenges a Sangha member is facing, that they can do it. You know, so I had a many years ago, somebody came to the Sangha and, you know, started talking to me and explaining how, like, I mean, that just had some really rough stuff happening over the last couple years. I mean, severe health problems and the loss of somebody. And so as he was describing this, I'm just picturing, you know, many people's responses might be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Oh no. You know, but if we can kind of hold that, you know, like with seriousness and hearing it, but not somehow kind of implying like, ooh, you're up shit creek. I don't know how you're going to deal with that. But acknowledging, like, we're all going to face very difficult things, but the idea is that, you know, we have it in us. We can do it. Sarah.
So Ruth Ann's comment about comparison sort of made me think comparison is really important. It allows you to determine like self versus others. It gives you like a sense of what's actually happening, and it gives you inspiration for what could happen, right? So if you wanted to make decisions or if you wanted to try something new, comparison is a way that can kind of expand your mind. So I would offer that it's the wisdom of figuring out how that comparison matches to reality, not necessarily a rejection of like comparison and you know, personal competition. Because there is value in seeing other people as they really are and how that relates to you and like what the situation really is. And that all requires kind of that level of discrimination. So just offering that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that like we are the differences are there. You know, and maybe I can't become a tree, but maybe I can learn some more self-discipline. You know, we don't know what our own potential is. And sometimes somebody else demonstrating what's possible, you know, maybe Alice's patient is a little inspired, you know, if they're not discouraged by seeing the other patient, maybe they're a little inspired by seeing, oh, you know, it is some folks at least are able to move past this and return to activity. So maybe that's possible for me. Let's see. Now we got Abdullah.
On Sarah's point of comparison, I thought that was beautiful. But also at a point where we do make that comparison to either better ourselves or see what's possible that we might have missed because someone else was able to accomplish it, I think that it should be said that if we come to a point to where we see that clearly the bag of tools that this person is working with, I don't have. I think we have to understand that personal effort counts a lot. You know, who's the better student? The guy who in class, he doesn't take notes, he doesn't do homework, but because, you know, he just has a sharp memory, he's able to get A's on the test because he just remembers everything with no effort. Or the guy who, even though he keeps getting C's, he goes out of his way to do research. He goes out of his way to study. He goes out of his way to pay attention in class. I mean, like, who really is better in that situation? One person is lazy and they just have a different bag of tools, whereas the other person is truly internally better than the other person. It's like, you know, one woman could look like the sun in a dress, you know what I'm saying? And another woman might not, but you know, is this one the sun in the dress? Is she really a better person? Is she really a better wife than this one? So I think once we get past those comparisons of the tools that we're working with, we have to understand that we still have the ability to be immense, You know, it's just a matter of personal effort. I might not be able to run as fast as you, but I'm going to train harder than you. And then I win like that.
I like it. All right. Well, about that time. I'll wrap it up. Thank you, everyone. So abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Damiel.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Thank you all.
Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you.